Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I'm Nick Ravelis, the host of UCSD-TV's Opera Talk and the Geisel Director of Education and Outreach for San Diego Opera. My passion is helping people understand opera and come to love it as much as I do. At San Diego Opera, my colleagues and I do that in many different ways, but one of my favorite events is the Artists' Roundtable. The San Diego Opera Artists' Roundtable is an intimate look at an exciting art form. I invite the principal artistic team for each production here to the Beverly Sills Salon for a freewheeling discussion before a live audience that covers everything from the music to the motivations of the characters to the director's stage vision and sometimes even a penetrating look at a singer's career. There's never a dull moment, and it's one of the joys of my job that I get to moderate these discussions. I think you'll enjoy it too.
This is the Artists' Roundtable surrounding our production of Charles Gounod's Romeo and Juliet. We're delighted to be able to present this production. First time I think we've done it in about 10 or 11 years is the last time we did it, I believe. It's a glorious, glorious opera with lots of wonderful tunes, lush orchestration, exciting sword fights that maybe we'll have the opportunity to talk a little bit about tonight, and brilliantly staged, I might add. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome our panel of artists. First of all, starting on my right, making her debut with San Diego Opera, the soprano who will be singing the role of Juliet, Eileen Perez. And sitting next to her, the tenor who will be singing the role of Romeo, also her husband in real life, Stephen Costello. And further down the table, then also making her debut, and by the way, Stephen is making his debut with us as well, making her debut as stage director for our production of Romeo and Juliet, the eminent Cynthia Stokes. And certainly not making her debut with San Diego Opera, our resident conductor, Karen Keltner. Next to her, also certainly not making his debut. Coming back after, I think, Kevin, how many productions have you done with us? Can you count?
Close to 12.
12 productions.
Yeah, over 20.
And we're always just delighted to have Kevin back. Bass, of course, singing the role of Friar Lawrence, Kevin Langan. It was like family coming back. This is great. Baritone, singing the role of Mercutio, Romeo's good friend, is baritone David Adam Moore. And last but not least, you may notice that I keep the pretty girls next to me and the villains at the end of the table.
I'm just misunderstood.
Yeah, that's right. The tenor who is singing the role of Tybalt, Joel Sorensen. So, there are Shakespeare operas, and there are Shakespeare operas. So, I think I'd like to start with Cynthia, and just let's put this opera in context in terms of how it lies with other operas that deal with Shakespeare plays, that deal with Shakespeare texts. Of course, we can think of Verdi's Otello, Macbetto, and Falstaff, the A Midsummer Night's Dream of Benjamin Britten, and a few others, actually many more others, but not too many that we know of, that are certainly not performed anymore. Mm-hmm. But in terms of its a parallel to the Gounod being parallel to the Shakespeare, how does it fare?
There are a lot of parallels. I also think that one of the things that's great about it is that Gounod really takes the best of Shakespeare when he when he and his collaborators made this piece. So they were really smart about the way they streamlined the story so that, you know, that you wouldn't be there for 15 hours. The other thing that's really wonderful is that there's a new character that's sort of an amalgamation of some of the servants that aren't super, super well developed, and that's Stefano, who is Romeo's page and is a trouser role that's sung by Sarah Castle. So that's I think that's a big piece of it. I'm not going to tell you how it ends.
Yeah.
But I think those are some of the parallels.
Mm-hmm. And it also ends up having the same five act structure.
It does have the same structure. Yep,
with,
you're right.
With the climax at the end of the third is
at the end
what is that called again?
The crisis or the
no the whole structure. I used to know that we were taught
structure?
This in high school. Remember?
Dramatic structure, yeah. Like the structure of a narrative, the wave.
Yeah,
the
yeah,
dramatic
yeah, yeah.
wave. You guys yeah. remember this from eighth grade? Sure. conflict, crisis. Yeah, exactly. And so when you see that, it'll be pretty apparent that there's a lot of dead bodies on the floor, and a lot of sword fighting that has gone on prior to that.
Does the music help Shakespeare? I mean, I may be saying that incorrectly, but do you feel that the music fits the spirit of the original play?
It does, sure. Because
I mean,
you know,
does it really tell the story? I
yeah.
guess.
Oh, absolutely. And also, you know, because it is so romantic, and there is that, you know, in the same way that the language in the Shakespeare is so lush and so beautiful, that the music lives in that same kind of world, and it's just mm-hmm. delicious.
Well, and it seems to me from the libretto, the librettists were very very. We really should mention the librettists,
mm-hmm.
Barbier
mm-hmm.
and Carré, yeah. who. I think worked very hard to capture some of the phrases that we know so well from the original play
yeah.
and translate them into French and keep them, you know, as intact as
in
they
the
could
forefront.
Possibly be.
Mm-hmm. I think so too. Yeah, yeah. And you know, one of the other things that they did with this is that in the play there is Lord and Lady Montague, and there's also Lady Capulet. And in the telling of this version of the story, really, they've only got Lord Capulet as the one adult figure who you know, it's his daughter. And so that's really the primary relationship. And really, if you look at the Shakespeare, you see that too, that the Montagues are worried about their son, but he's pulling away from them as adolescent boys do, and that they're far less central to the telling of the story. And so, you know, they just extradited them from mm-hmm. it.
Karen, just if you would for a moment talk to us about the music itself. It is eminently French, and I think that's always good to sort of refresh our memories in terms of what French opera means and what it is
at this point. I think one of the hallmarks of French opera, of course, is its sense of... elegance and dignity and moderation. Even the fights are à la française, c'est-à-dire they're musically constructed in a very logical, very descriptive way. I don't mean that they're weak or pale in any sense, but there's very little hellfire and brimstone in the Italian sense. The orchestration is for double winds. There is doubling, however, of a second oboe and English horn. But there are two clarinets, there are two bassoons. And with this, of course, Gounod, who was, you know, grandfather probably, or the father of a certain kind of French taste and discernment, sculpts these beautifully descriptive, extremely melodic. If you want melody, come, because you will be able to sing and hum to your heart's delight, hopefully not in the theater, unless it's for quiet. And with us, you know, in time. But it's one beautiful melody after another. He almost couldn't help himself as far as I've even heard that he was criticized for, you know, leaning too much on melody. Long lines in certain ways that are very, very French, very, very contained, not huge leaps, none of Abigail's pyrotechnics, but certainly great taste, great sense of and line of phrase, and again, this eloquence that has a certain majesty and nobility to it that I think you only find with the French composers, and certainly with Gounod.
Well, the piece premiered at the Théâtre Lyrique, and I think that just makes an awful lot of sense. This is
the most lyrical
of operas. It's just gorgeous and sumptuous, I think, is a great word for it. Let's talk about some of the characters, and I think as I'm going to each singer, I'd like to also find out what some of the challenges are for the role. But I'd like to start with Friar Lawrence. Friar Lawrence is a wonderful example of a basse cantante, a singing bass, which I guess was a specialized voice type in French literature in the 19th century. How would you describe the role?
I think that's a good way to call it, Nick. It's the basso cantante was a term to mean the singing bass. It's loosely means the bass who is the character of Friar Lawrence is a very sympathetic character. Obviously, he's the one person who is friends with both sides of the feuding families here. He's good friends with Romeo and Juliet. And it's in the sense that it's a sympathetic character, the music is very sympathetic. And along those lines, I was going to add to what Karen just said. Charles Gounod was a very close friend of the school of Italian bel canto in the 19th century, of people like Manuel Garcia and Lamperti, who were the two considered most important vocal teachers of the 19th century of the bel canto style. And I learned about them through the teacher that I had at Indiana University, where I went to school. Margaret Harshaw was my teacher. Margaret Harshaw, the lineage of what she taught, she was a student of Anna Schön René, who taught at the Juilliard School back in the 1940s. And Anna Schön René was a student of Pauline Viardot Garcia. That goes way back.
Yeah.
Now, the Garcias were well known as not only teachers of music, but as performers in the 19th century. They had a traveling troupe that actually came to America and in the 1840s, 50s, and traveled all over the United States. I don't know if they came as far as California. I know they traveled into the southern United States, into Texas.
They were in New Orleans.
Mexico, in New Orleans, and also went into Mexico as well. But Charles Gounod was very closely associated with these people because he really did believe in the bel canto style of singing that these people were championing and teaching. And so you see that in the operas that he wrote, in Romeo, in Faust. So it was interesting. My teacher told me that when I was studying with her at Indiana, she said, yes, during this period when Garcia and Pauline Viardot, who was his daughter, Pauline Viardot Garcia, were traveling, they oftentimes met with Gounod, and they discussed the type of music that they wanted to sing, and Gounod took this into account when he was writing his music and writing his operas. So I think that's just a kind of an interesting, you know, footnote and side note to what Karen was saying about the style of French opera at the time and how it was closely related to the teachers of bel canto music of the time as well.
Well, and Viardot was instrumental in kicking off Gounod's career.
Exactly. She
absolutely
she championed his music. Yeah.
And his very first opera, Sappho, was written for her.
For her, I believe. Yeah, that's right.
So
that's
there's a direct connection.
Yeah.
I'm so glad to know that. That's
terrific. Yeah.
You'll see I'm jumping around. Let's get to the couple here, Romeo and Juliet. Let's all start with Juliet. And ask you, I think one of the things that I've always been struck with by the role of Juliet, and similar to the role of Marguerite, that it seems as if it requires two different sopranos. I know that's perhaps a little bit of hyperbole, but you have this, you know, you start off in Act One as being a lyric coloratura in a sense, and then you grow and become more and more dramatic, and then you have this poison aria, which I assume the tessitura of lies a little bit lower. Does that make it a tough and particularly hard or long sing for you?
I can speak coming from a very long sing of a Violetta in La Traviata, for example, which lies low, but also has that, you know, that sempre libera, where you get this it could be interpolated even a high E flat. With learning new roles and being a soprano, it seems like every role I hit starts off with this, a lot of gleaming coloratura, and then sort of tapers and she grows. The mm-hmm. heroine grows, and it's a longer lyric line. So thankfully, I've had some experience with some other roles. But with Juliet, I think what I find is particularly French, just to keep going on musically, and also reflected in the music. The youth and vibrancy
freshness.
Well, the joie de vivre, oui. Right? Mm-hmm. In her joie de vivre is all this beautiful chromaticism, and it's silvery quick. And then by the time we meet her as she's contemplating her death and her demise, if she were to marry Paris, and after she's already taken her vow with Romeo, and you get this a real growth in her lyricism. I just think that when one follows the words and the vocal arch of it, Gounod wrote in about a 40-minute pause between this big change and shift for her, which I think is sheer genius, and that a composer, maybe he thought of it, maybe not. I'm thinking he did. Just because when you write two lead roles, you have to think about how are the singers going to get through the night, and making also, you know, probably having that in the back of their minds. And so I really appreciate after our scene in the marriage, I have, you know, I even asked the assistant stage managers for the timings. I have about 40 minutes break where I can just, you know, pause, and the next time you see me is after I've forgiven him for killing Tybalt and telling him, you know, you're my life now. This is our fate. Our fate is together, and you are my life.
A very convenient 40 minutes.
Nice. So I think it's a genius move on the composer to give Juliet this time to offstage to then come into the new scene with, she's still sorting it out, but by the time, I mean, then it just elevates her mission, her goal to this almost, it's a heroic level, really. It really is, so.
Stephen, you don't get 40 minutes off.
I wish. Yeah. I got 40 minutes off now.
So, you know, I would assume that it's a tough sing. Again, this we talked about this a little bit when we did the interview for radio program that actually will be coming up, I believe, next week. We'll have that interview on Excellency One. Casting of this role has been different depending on different eras. I mean, sometimes it's been almost a dramatic tenor role that's been considered. Mm-hmm. I think even of some of the early 20th century French tenors, we're looking at Jean Doreski and Georges Thiel and people like that who had just really hefty voices. On the other hand, Jussi Björling sang this role, who was just the eminent lyric tenor. Do you think it fits one kind of tenor or another, or can you approach it that differently and make it work?
I think it can be approached by all types of tenors, lyric tenors, dramatic tenors. But being a singer, you have to watch. I mean, it's mostly the pacing of the role. I mean, if you give too much too soon, you have a very, very long night ahead of you. Because it does kind of start out in the way that Eileen was talking about with Juliet. It's very, very lyric in the beginning, and it's very especially the balcony scene and the duet in the first act is very, very lyric. And then you get to the street scene, which is where Romeo kills Tybalt, and that, that can get very, very heroic. And I know for myself, it's a great scene. The music's so great and so passionate that you tend to want to really give everything and really put on, I mean, put on a show. But you have to realize after that, you still have an entire bedroom scene and then the tomb scene, which is probably equally as dramatic to seeing as the street scene. So, and especially the way that we're doing it in this production, we have an intermission after Act One. So for me, the balcony scene and the street scene are connected. So that's probably, what, about an hour of music, and I'm probably singing maybe 30 minutes of it. So it's a long sing for me. So, you know, it, but the role is, I mean, it's also a dramatic role. I mean, it's a Shakespearean role, and the character is something that, that requires a lot of dramaticism as well. So when you put that, I mean, the staging and your characterization into your body, you're not only talking about your voice, but you're also talking about your body getting physically tired. So one thing we have to watch is when you're in rehearsals, I mean, because we have to rehearse every day since we have such a short, we have a short rehearsal period until we open, that you have to really pace yourself, not only during the run of the show, but during the rehearsal process as well. Because I know we have fight scenes with Tybalt, and Tybalt and Mercutio have fight scenes. So, I mean, once you're, once, you could not sing a note, but once your body gives out, your voice is bound to give out as well. So you really, I mean, it's you have to, when you take on this role, you have to understand that, you know, it's a role that you love to sing, and it's a role that has great music, but it's also a role that you can't force yourself to do every day. That you really have to just, you know, when you go home, you have to rest, you have to eat well, you have to, exercising is great. You have to take care of yourself in order to sing a role like this. Just as we were talking about with any Verdi role, you have to rest and you have to take care of yourself because Verdi roles are very demanding as well. Having done Otello and doing this, I mean, I only did Cassio in Otello, but you know, that's the same way. I mean, the first scene, the first has a sword fight with Montano, and you just really, I mean, you have to pace yourself, or you can, and you can get very, very exhausted very, very fast.
Since you brought up Tybalt, let's move to Tybalt and talk about the sword fighting. There's quite a bit of physical action in what is the Gounod's third act, and at the end of our second act. First of all, I guess, how's that going?
I'm sore. I think when I was here last year, someone told me that Dale Girard was going to be the fight coordinator. And I did Romeo and Juliet 10 years ago, and he was the fight coordinator, and he almost killed me then. So I actually started working out pretty heavily. It was back in April or May. And I was saying to my wife the other night, I cannot imagine if I had not done that what state I would be in, because we had a music rehearsal on Tuesday, and then I did about 2 hours, and then Wednesday we did 6 hours, and Thursday we did 6 hours, and Friday we did an hour and a half in the afternoon, and then we did all evening long. And Saturday was...
It was all with the chorus, yeah.
Saturday was a lot of it, too. And... which is good, because you only have to do it once during the performance. So if you can do it 3, 4, 5, 6 times on a day and survive, then chances are you're gonna make it.
And do it the same way each time.
Each time. And I mean, it's very well choreographed, and everyone tells me that it looks great. So I have to go on their say, because I'm too busy trying not to get killed.
It's frightening. Yeah. It scares me, I must say. I'm down there going.
But see, that's the idea. If you know, there's nothing worse than watching. It's like watching a movie and they have this huge action scene, and at some point the director yells cut, and you've got two lame brains in the back who are just kind of like doing this, and it just ruins the whole thing, you know. But it's been good, and I think, you know, very well choreographed, and you hope that you kind of scare people. That's the idea. So.
But now all that physical activity in that scene and sing. So what are the challenges inherent in that? Is it is the fight well-paced for your singing to be able to be successful in the scene?
Well, I mean, I think we can praise the composer again. I mean, the initial duel is relatively short, and then you have my biggest thing, and it's all about tempo. And so, bless Karen. Mm-hmm. Because I've discussed it with Karen quite a bit. If it gets, you don't want it to be too slow, because then the momentum is lost and you've got to keep the dramatic energy. But if it gets too fast, and it's really just a click or two on the metronome, if it gets too fast, then the moments to breathe and draw air is lessened. And when you've got big muscles, when you've been hopping around, then your legs, they're all drawing oxygen too. And so it's really about tempo, and it's finding the right tempo. And so Karen's been very gracious in helping you with that. So, because you are, I mean, it's really getting sufficient air to really to put it through. Yeah. So,
to these fellows' credit, I must say that we're not talking huge divides of tempo. We're talking here and there. And it can make all the difference to a singer. I do believe that one of the jobs of the conductor is to show the singer at his or her best. And that means being able to adequately, obviously, breathe as well as sing. And so I have a hard time with people who say, no, this is my tempo and I don't deviate. I think you have to be able to be human with the human who's singing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's why I said it's really just one or two clicks on the metronome. It's not a huge difference, but it can be a huge difference, because that eighth note suddenly becomes a little too
exactly.
short
exactly.
To draw the air. Yeah, because you're also sometimes get into a situation where you need to exhale before you take back in, because what you've got inside is stale. And and that sounds really funny, but it's not just filling your lungs. It's also having the oxygen your muscles need, and and when you're singing, you're expelling carbon dioxide. But if you don't have the oxygen your muscles need, I mean, these are just muscles,
yep.
You know, and they're the smallest ones, so they're going to get it last. So,
this is a very athletic cast, and a very young American cast, which I think is terrific. The only non-American is Sarah Castle, who's from New Zealand and is singing the trouser role of Stefano. Everybody else is from the States, and I think that says yes.
I'm Texan.
Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot about the Republic of Texas. That's right. That's right. Well, and we were going to get to you next, so why don't we just go to Mercutio? David Adam Moore is singing the role of Mercutio. Now, you have, we've talked about this, this wonderful aria, which is based on the Queen Mab speech that Mercutio has in the original Shakespeare, which is extremely wordy. And I
Both
must,
yeah,
and I'll defer to Cynthia, but it would seem to me that an actor doing Mercutio would have to bring that thing off with just lots of dynamism and lots of electricity. It's got to be quick, because the images are quick. I think Gounod did an excellent job with the piece.
Absolutely.
Talk to me about just the challenge of singing that aria, which you sing within the first 2 minutes that you're on stage.
Yeah. Well, the aria is very, I would describe it as psychedelic, really. It's very colorful. It's very fast-paced. There's some sort of, he brings up, I don't know, dozens of different images within this aria that many composers would, or in other situations, maybe you would have an entire aria devoted to. But he's just, his mind is racing, and this aria really expresses that. There are lots of chromatic, very, very fast chromatic ascents and descents that give you the sense of, he's talking about, you know, little magical insects and fairies buzzing around.
Give us the background. Who is Queen Mab?
Queen Mab is the, I'm trying to... I'm sorry, I have to translate this from French in my mind. She's the queen of dreams. She's the one. She's the mythical being who comes and causes people to have often misleading dreams and fantasies and illusions. So, you know, in the aria, he talks about how Queen Mab is the one that that makes the miser imagine himself surrounded by riches. It makes the lover dream of being in love, the prisoner dream of being free, the soldier dream of pulling off a successful ambush and then basking in the public glory that he receives from it. That's Queen Mab.
Great. And musically, I think it matches the original Shakespeare so beautifully. It really captures each of those wonderful images, and just, you know, it's like a quicksilver, mercurial piece.
Absolutely mercurial. And it really brings out a lot about the character psychologically. I think of Mercutio as this guy who's, at the very least, he's ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, at the very, very least. And I think from that, you could play that anywhere on the continuum from a bit ADD to absolutely psychotic. And so it's a fascinating character.
Mm. Romeo and Juliet again. Now this is a question for the two of you, and you don't need to get too personal. But the fact is, you're a married couple, and you're singing for the first time together. Mm-hmm. Roles of a young married couple. Are you finding any? How does one put this? Extra energy, inspiration, in the fact that in real life. You are connected, and you're connected on stage. I mean, how do those two modes of life affect you, or how are you discovering something new about singing or about the relationship? Just going through this experience.
Well, we've been married for a year, so the romance is gone already.
It's been. I don't know. Do you want to do it or?
Now I'm going to get in trouble.
Yeah.
I always find it a joy to sing with my wife. There's no greater experience. But I mean, we each are very different singers, and we're both very different artists. So, I mean, and same thing with everyone at this table. So whenever you work with somebody, you learn things from them because you watch everybody work on stage, and you watch everybody sing, and you realize how they do it. So, I mean, every time we sing together, we learn something from each other as well. Being married and being in a career together, you have to just learn, you know, where the line is. And when you come home, you can't let, you know, your work affect your personal lives, because in the end of the day, one of us could not sing tomorrow, and we still have, you know, however many years we're alive together. So you have to. There's a fine line of business and relationship. And when we're in rehearsal, you know, I wouldn't treat her any different than I would treat anybody else at the table, and I would expect that from her as well. I mean, with the fact that I'm cheering for her a little more. But,
Jeez, Simon.
Well, except for you.
Eileen?
I'm very inspired working with him. He's really handsome, and of course, I mean, I know he's my husband, but that voice, when you're singing, you know, it's very rare, even in the repertoire that we've learned together, that the leads actually sing in harmony. A lot of in the Italian repertoire, you'll have duets, but they kind of like get to sing in harmony by the end of the opera. I'll say a line, and he'll say a line, and I'll say a line, and they'll call that the duet, right? But this time, it starts off with line, 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 but we come together to sing that gorgeous bedroom scene when we're in harmony, and it's just so much fun.
Mm.
And it's fun to, you know, because I know him, to just allow our voices to arch together,
mm-hmm.
it's just a great thrill. And because there was a time where he held out a B flat longer than was planned in a production
well, that's
before.
Not what happened. If you're going to tell the story, you might as well tell the story.
We were in Michigan doing Elysier, and no, because you're going to tell it wrong. We were in Michigan Opera Theater doing Elysier, and we were asked because of financial reasons to do a second performance the next day, which usually there's a second cast for, but they couldn't bring in a second cast for it. So they said, "Would you mind singing a Friday night show and a Saturday night show?" And I said, "Of course, you know, it's something to try, something I wanted to do, and something that Eileen wanted to do as well." And usually, I mean, you have a day or two in between each show, so the singer after that show can rest the next day, review all of the music from the last show, just so it's fresh in their head and ready. Well, I didn't do that. I didn't do that on Saturday because I figured I did it last night. I know it. And the first thing that Marino comes out and does is sing "Quanto è bella." And I got out there, I sang "Quanto è bella, quanto è cara." Forgot the rest of it. Forgot the rest of it. You know, and it was just, you know, it's a role that I've done, you know, tons of times, and I just could not remember the aria to save my life. And then we got to the middle section, I got right back on, and the conductor was mouthing me the words, and it wasn't helping. So, got to the middle section, I got back on, and the A section of the second verse came back to my head, and I was like, "I've got this," and I held out this big, "Ah, quanto è bella, quanto è cara." Forgot the rest of it again. So now I turn around because I'm in this like apron and this ice because I was an ice cream salesman. That's another story. So I turn around and I'm like, you know what? I've got to make up for this performance. So from that point on, it was my job to just take every high note and hold it as long as I can. However, Nemorino doesn't come off of the stage until the end of Act One, so I never had time to tell Adina. So when I started to hold it, I just kind of took her by surprise, and then she just had to go with it until we got off the stage and said, "What did you do?" And I said, "I had to make up for it somehow, please."
Is that your recollection?
Uh-huh. That's how I tell the story.
Yeah. I won't ask you to tell your side of the story.
It was long, and it was unexpected, and I was up there. And then it just kept going, and he got louder and louder, and I'm going, "Oh!" Bam!
Cynthia, I was just in the theater and saw the set.
Ooh, yeah.
And, you know, I had thought that we were using the same set that we used 10 years ago, and I didn't recognize it at all, and then I was informed it's not at all the same production. And what struck me was that it has a kind of Shakespearean convention about it.
It does feel like one of the old theaters.
It really does. Yeah, well, I remember vividly at the Globe a number of years ago a Twelfth Night with Marcia Mason.
Yeah.
And it was set in a replica of the library where Twelfth Night was originally presented mm-hmm. in England. And it's just, you know, it doesn't change. It's not really a set. It's just this, you know, the interior of a library.
It's architecture, right.
But that's kind of what it seems to me that the designer was going for with this. And does that help in terms of getting a Shakespearean feel to the piece?
You know what it does is I think, and Stephen talked a little bit about this idea of like the acts that are connected. And what I think this does is that it lets us play through the story. So that we do go from the balcony to the wedding to the courtyard without really, I mean, there's a breath and there's music, but that the story just plays through. And I think that's just so important, especially, I guess, for a modern audience, not to have those times where it's just, this happens so many times in opera, where it's just like, and we wait. And you
scene
hear the clunk,
change.
Clunk, clunk, clunk backstage, yeah. So this is really beautiful. We're working to make sure that all the set changes actually happen al vista. So you'll see the wall come in, and you'll see different things happening as really great music is playing, if everything goes right.
This is a slightly different cut, too. Maybe I'll address this to Karen. There are things added. There are things subtracted. It's not... What am I trying to say? It's not the complete score, but I think it's a much tighter telling of the story in a way.
Well, Cynthia and I had discussed this, and it was very important to her and to me that this be focused on the two youngsters of Romeo and Juliet and their story. So we have done that, and I must say I also admired and still admire greatly much of the work of Richard Bonning, for whom French music, I think, is a real specialty. And I loved some of the spacing and selection that he had done in a prior production. I found it did exactly what you said. It made things very tight. It did not take our focus away from these young people, these youngsters who are living this amazing story in a very short amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, we have, but you know, French opera is known for that. I mean, for switching things around and adding things in. Every time I'm confronted with a French opera, I'm thrilled, and then I think, oh, and we have to make all these decisions.
Let's talk about the tales of Hoffman,
or even
Carmen.
Well, yes, and any of them. I mean, there are things that, unless you want to sit in the theater for 4.5 hours, which nobody today wants to, you do pick and choose. And we made our choices based on what we thought was integral to the story and the tightness and the tautness of keeping the story on focus, and also how we wanted the scenes to unfold. We've added a scene that often is cut, which is that scene after the poison aria, actually, which often ends that particular act. But we've added the little scene after it where the father Capulet comes into his daughter's bedroom and she actually appears to him to die in front of him. That was very important to Cynthia, and it was interesting because we discussed it and then had a misunderstanding, not an argument, but I had understood it one way and she'd understood. Anyway, we're doing it. And
well, it's a very touching scene. I think it's a marvelous close
up
of that act
that often isn't heard or seen. So
yeah,
yes,
it's beautiful.
We have picked and chosen, and we hope that you appreciate it.
Yeah, go ahead.
Can I add to that one part? Because something in that scene particularly, there is
that
the
text,
line that
comes back.
Yeah,
and
right. You can hear Gounod set fate in music, and it happens when Tybalt says, "Who is that man you're speaking to?" I say, "I don't know. Why is he avoiding me?" And then he says, or Romeo says to Tybalt, "Okay, like, God bless you, sir," you know. And Tybalt says, "Oh my God, I recognize that's my enemy, right?"
Mm-hmm.
It's him. It's Romeo, and that's when I say, "Romeo, that's his name, right?" And I know he's a Montague. And the shift musically, it is just the most gorgeous, fatalistic music you'll ever hear. And because we're doing that often cut scene where she's taking the poison and dies, you hear that music come back, and she whispers that line once more to Gertrude, and then she's gone.
Mm.
But it's great because then you kind of get the leitmotif that Gounod was inspired with from Wagner by. You get that fate. You can hear that fatal music. I hope when you hear it in the theater, you're like, "Yeah, that's fate. Oh no! Oh no! It's here!"
Exactly. She says it twice. It's hatred is the cradle of
this fatal love.
This doomed love, and the coffin will be my bridal bed. And it's an amazing line, and she sings it. It's a quote each time. It's the same, and it's. Eileen brought up the shift. You know, the French are quite remarkable. There's not a lot of preparation for these shifts in this music. They happen sometimes with absolutely no preparation, and yet they maintain this elegance of style and moderation. So you know orally you're in a different place, and stylistically you're in a different place, but it's been done with a minimum of hubbub. It just, all of a sudden you're there. It's a hugely admirable trait, I find, and one of utter genius, because a lot of composers, of course, do it their way, but it's with much more flourish. This is just done, and now this, and now we're here, and now we're here. It's just lovely, and she does it beautifully, I must say.
I'd like to move from the topic of the opera itself and just talk a little bit about career. And one of the things that is inspiring me to do this is that I had a wonderful conversation with David Aramercusio in New York. I was there for an Opera America Conference of Education Directors, and I took the opportunity to interview him there rather than wait till he came here for the radio program. And one of the things that we got into was where he comes from. Now, we know it's Texas, but what I think is absolutely fascinating, David, is your family background. And I wonder if you would share a little bit of that with the audience.
Sure. I'm a sixth-generation professional musician. I'm the first one to go classical. In fact, I'm the first one to go anything but country. The previous five generations... the previous five generations were all country western musicians who... Obviously, this stretched back to before we knew of... before country western as a genre existed. It was kind of, you know, Appalachian and Irish-influenced folk music. My grandfather had his own radio show when he was like 12 years old or something like that. And we're from Southeast Texas. And to this day, I'm still the only one who's left. And my father played with a top 10 country western group for about 15 years. A solo artist named Tracy Byrd. Not many opera fans have heard of him, but had a lot of radio hits and such. And so, I certainly continued the path of music. But
did any of that prepare you for opera? I guess the question that's been big is, was there drama in the family then that prepared you for opera? No, that's not what I mean. But I mean, vocally, I mean, did you sing with your relatives and your father
and
grandfather?
It's funny, I was never a singer growing up. I always wanted to play an instrument. I always wrote music. I never thought of myself as a singer until I started training as an opera singer. So it's actually really bizarre when I go back home. Up until recently, my grandfather was playing four nights a week in a club in this little beer joint outside of Beaumont, Texas. And my dad still plays. He's got his own band. There, and people are always on me, "Oh, you need to get up there and sing. Get up there and sing something. We want to hear you sing." And I'm always trying to think of what could I sing.
The Ballad of Queen Mab, of course.
Yeah, what could I sing for them that they would possibly, you know, appreciate? And I cannot sing in a country style.
David, what clicked? What sent you to opera instead of country western?
I think I was sort of oversaturated with, you know, the music that came from there and that culture because I grew up in it. I'd had enough, so when I was a teenager, when I was an early teenager, I really got into electronic music and post-punk and things like that. And then I discovered classical music at about age 16, 17, and was just completely enraptured, and that's when this whole journey started.
It's interesting. Joel, could you just, again, I don't want to get too personal about this, but I mean, we all know we're in a recession right now, and it must be tremendously difficult for singers because, you know, the conservatories and the universities haven't stopped graduating hundreds and hundreds of musicians every
80,
year.
80,000 about every 4 years.
Yeah. So what's it like, given that atmosphere right now and given, you know, the lack of funding for the arts on top of the recession, What's it like for a singer out there right now?
I'd say it's frightening is a good word to put it. I actually, last year was really very difficult because I sang here. I did Don Quixote here, and then I had nothing between that and August. Mm. And I was supposed to go to Los Angeles and cover Graham Clark and Siegfried, and I had no money. I'm married. I have two children. The bank, you know, I pay the bank for my house. My wife, God bless her, she's amazing. She had squirreled away a lot of money. And so we were able, I mean, she said, if nothing goes wrong, we can get to August. But the problem was that I wasn't going to have the capital to front to go to L.A. because, you know, you've got to rent an apartment. And, I mean, the cost of living out here is just, I'm sorry, you guys are nuts.
Yeah, yeah, it's true.
Providence, you know, I'm not going to go into theology, but San Francisco lost their Spoleta and Tosca. And so I was literally driving up the Garden State Parkway, and the phone rings, and how soon can you be on a plane to San Francisco? Well, how soon do I need to be on a plane to San Francisco? So that sort of got us through, and then some things changed, and I ended up being at the Met in the fall instead of going out to Los Angeles. So, but I mean, that period of time, I had two jobs in the fall, which were smaller regional theaters, so you don't tend to make a huge fee there, and you're squeaking by. And when you have to look your son in the eye and say, no, we're not going to McDonald's today because we can't afford the nuggets, you know, it's really, really pretty bad. So it's a difficult time, and I'm very blessed because we knew the downturn was coming. I had colleagues who had big contracts with theaters that had closed and declared one form of bankruptcy or another, and they're just out. I had one colleague, 80% of his annual income gone like that. So it's a tough time, and that's why, you know, the thing about the recession, and you probably know this, is that opera, the arts, symphony, it doesn't matter. We're sort of the last group to benefit from a good economy, but we're the first group to suffer from a bad economy. And so it's tough all over. I think there are six companies in this country with greater than 50-year histories that are now gone.
Yeah.
And so it's can be a little scary, really.
Thank you for sharing that with us. I appreciate that. Kevin, just one last question. You teach, right?
I do some teaching, yes.
Yeah.
I'm not doing it full time.
How is this affecting young students who are looking at a career in the future? You're working with students, obviously, who are, you know, perhaps hoping for some kind of an operatic career. Do you see students fleeing from that, or are people still sort of embracing it and hoping for the best? Or?
No, I don't see that. I mean, I just finished teaching for 3 weeks at Westminster Choir College for my wife, who is a full-time teacher, but she's up in Seattle right now doing some performances of Falstaff. So I stepped in and helped her by teaching her kids for 3 weeks. So I was able to talk to the kids a lot about this. I told them, I said, this is a cycle we're going through, and it is. I've been in the business for 30 years, so I've seen the ups and the downs. This is a down period. We're actually at the end of it, I think. I always look at the glass half full rather than half empty, because I'm already beginning to see work coming in on now that wasn't there a year ago, 2 years ago. And I tell these kids, you're going to go through these cycles in your career where there's going to be times when you're going to be getting a lot of work and there's going to be times when you're not getting any work. So you have to make adjustments. And when you are working, you squirrel the money away. You don't stay in the best hotels. You don't fly business class to your jobs, even though you know you can afford it at the time because you think you're making a lot of money. Yeah, we do. When we do sing, we do tend to make a lot of money. And sometimes the young singers don't understand that it's not always going to be that way. and that you have to put it away for a rainy day. So I actually do a seminar for young singers in schools about the business end of what we do, and try to explain all this to them, you know, along with a lot of other things that we have to deal with as self-employed business people in this line of work. But I do tell them, this is a cycle we're going through right now, and hopefully we're on the end of it, and things are going to get better, and I think that they will. But you just have to just ride it out, you know, and do the best that you can. And we're all, I mean, as Joel was saying, it's not just, you know, the young singers that are suffering from this. I'm talking everybody in our business is suffering, right up to the top. To the top singers in our business, they're feeling it as well. I know a lot of them, and I won't name names, but very, very famous opera singers who have lost contracts and gigs over the last couple of years, and are having to deal with it as well as the rest of it. So it's across the board. No one is being spared at all with this recession that we've gone through.
And I just add that, I mean, whenever I have been asked to talk to young singers, I mean, after I tell them to run as fast as they can in the opposite direction. And Lamperti said that. I mean, but the lack of understanding of just what it costs to stay, you know, they do it now, but when I was in college, they didn't teach the business of singing. And I mean, literally, I say to them, you open up a separate account, and you take that check and you cut it in half, and you stick half of that in there, and you don't touch it, because it's the only way that you're going to meet your tax obligations and everything. So, and it's true, about 50, you take home about 50% of what you make. Mm-hmm. So the fees may look really glitzy, but they get really small really fast.
And it's even less when you go to Europe.
You're lucky
if you can clear 40%.
And when you consider, I mean, I think perhaps some members of the audience don't realize that when singers come into town, they pay for their housing. Be it a hotel or, you know, we'll try and set up a nice place for them to live. But, I mean, the singers will pay for it. The singers will pay for their own food, you know, and you know, all of their incidentals. And they don't get paid until they actually sing. Mm-hmm. So someone gets sick in the middle of a rehearsal period and has to drop out, and another person comes in, that original singer does not get paid a dime.
If you get sick for a performance out of four, in our case here, we're doing four of the Romeo and Juliet. You're sick for one, that's a quarter of your fee gone. Because if you don't sing, you don't get paid. You know, so you have to stay healthy. Yeah,
it's a tough business. It's something we've never really talked about at Artists Roundtable. I just wonder, because of the unusual financial situation that all of us find ourselves in. Not that San Diego Opera is in bad condition. That's not what I'm saying. But I mean, globally, the recession that we're experiencing right now really does affect what happens in terms of producing opera, which is still the most expensive art form to produce. So I encourage all of you to tell your friends and your family to get a ticket to Romeo and Juliet. This is truly a spectacular production. You will not believe the voices. They're so wonderful. I've heard some of the rehearsals, and I'm just thrilled that we've got all of you wonderful artists here.
If the hair on the back of your neck doesn't stand up in this performance, then you're not human. Because I'll tell you, this is a great opera, and there's some great singing up here with all these people.
It's terrific.
It's really a special show that you're going to be seeing. So.
Thank you all very, very much for being here.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.